Hello and welcome. This is Sharon. I'll be bringing you the pantograph for today, Wednesday, April 2nd, 2025. We'll begin our reading on the front page with an article entitled Election 2025 Turnout: Fewer Voters But Big Impact. Officials: Turnout Light for Races Shaping Cities and Schools. David Lafort of Bloomington headed to the Den at Fox Creek Golf Course Tuesday morning to cast his ballot in the consolidated local election because he believes it is residents' collective duty to vote and actively participate in the community. "I think it's important to make sure that we have our say," Lafort said. "I really believe people need to understand that even one vote counts, and it seems like the divisiveness of the country right now, it's extremely important to get out and let your voice be heard." Despite the passion for civic duty, some voters expressed on Election Day, early indications Tuesday pointed to a lower voter turnout in McLean County, election officials said. McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael said she was somewhat surprised to see how slow the morning had been at polling places in Normal. "Just my gut of being in politics for so long, I thought there would be a rush in the morning," she said. Michael predicted Normal will see about 35-40% turnout overall, which is approximately what the town saw 4 years ago. But turnout for the rest of McLean County brought the average down to 20% in 2021. More rural parts of the county, however, were seeing a decent turnout Tuesday, she noted. Hayworth, for example, also has a contested mayoral race, and by about noon on Tuesday, the village had more than 200 voters turn out of the 3,000 registered, which is the highest Michael's office has seen reported so far. Lexington and Money Creek Township had a nice turnout as well, Michael said. But some pockets of the county, where races were uncontested, had seen as few as 13 voters on Tuesday. "Voters were slow but steady," Michael said. "We had about 100 or so at our larger churches, which isn't a lot. We had average numbers for early voting and mail-in, but they weren't bad. But we will see what happens this afternoon." With calm and sunny weather, Michael said she hoped to see more voters hit the polls as the day continued. The McLean County Clerk's Office received 2,967 mail-in ballots and had 1,567 early voters, according to its online tally. Michael noted there had been no significant problems or major complaints from voters as of early Tuesday afternoon, aside from two minor machine glitches. She said that was normal, which is why they have extra machines. Luke Stremlaw, executive director of the Bloomington Election Commission, said as of 12:30 p.m. Tuesday, 7,830 voters had cast their ballots in Bloomington, including mail-in ballots and early voters. "Turnout is going right along as anticipated, right around 20-21% turnout right now. I would anticipate that possibly going up to 25%, a little higher." He noted an increase of voters over the lunch hour, with about 1,000 votes cast from around 11 a.m. to noon. Stremlaw said he anticipated voting would pick up again later in the afternoon, when most people are off work. Velda Williams, 73, of Bloomington, said she and her husband have been Bloomington residents their whole lives, and he always encourages her to vote in every election. "If I don't vote, how can I complain about who gets elected? So it's a very important choice to make," Williams said. While Williams said she is typically more passionate about presidential elections, she thinks the lower voter turnout for local elections is terrible. To encourage more voters, she said the community should share more information about the local elections, tell residents how important they are, and offer more avenues for voting, especially for the elderly, at nursing homes and in hospitals. Tristan Knoll, a 23-year-old student at Illinois State University, said he sees voting as a civic duty. Local elections have historically been pretty underrepresented, and most of the time people just vote for the primary, presidential elections, and maybe the midterms. So yeah, I just feel like I should. May as well do something, he said. Knoll said he wasn't sure what can be done to encourage more to vote in local elections, but he thinks the elections should advertise more to students, aside from the usual go vote signs. Wayne Dillo, an election judge at Heartland Community College, said he served as an election judge for nearly 40 years. Despite the polling place being located on a college campus, Dillo said he doesn't typically see many students turn out for local elections, even though they live in the community, for 9 or 10 months of the year. As of 10 a.m. Tuesday, the polling location had reported 107 voters. "I'm actually a little surprised," Dillo said. "I was not expecting quite that many, but we have over 3,000 registered voters in the 4 precincts at this polling place, so that's still not a very high number." Dillo said he believes it's important for residents to participate in local elections because it directly affects them. He said it is also important for voters to do their own research on who is running and the key issues, instead of relying on a family member, for example, to tell them how to vote. "The town spends millions of dollars, and it comes from us. So if you want to say in where that money is spent, it's important to be able to vote for the mayor, the town council, and even the township offices. There are things that they're making decisions on that are important to listen to and have some input into," he said. Richard Szflarski of Normal was one of those 107 who voted at Heartland on Tuesday morning. He said he votes because he thinks if people have the right to vote, they should. "It's all local. Whatever votes happen at your town council are going to impact you more than what's happening at the federal level." He said if residents had the day off for election day, more people would vote in local elections. He also noted some people have to cook, take care of their kids or pets, and may be too tired. Brian Barnes, an election judge at the Den at Fox Creek, said he has been participating as an election judge on and off for about 20 years. He said he was motivated to participate by his many ancestors who served in the military. "My dad jumped out of airplanes in World War II to protect our rights to do this, to vote. I figure if he did that, I can do this," Barnes said. As for voter turnout, he said in consolidated elections, he typically sees about a third of the voters that turn out for fall presidential elections. Barnes said he wishes more people cared about their local elections and took more of an interest, since it doesn't take much time to vote. "But unfortunately, it's not something residents can be forced to participate in," he said. "Local elections actually impact you quite often directly, a more lot than any statewide or national elections. This is where the decisions get made about fixing roads, local projects that really directly impact your life," he said. "There are also early voting and mail-in options, so there's really no reason not to participate," he added. Today's Flick Fact question: it's an uphill and then downhill drive from Bloomington Normal to Peoria. which city is actually highest elevation-wise? At 830 feet above sea level, Bloomington Normal is one of Illinois' highest cities, as Bloomington Normal sits atop one of Illinois' highest plains. Peoria, meanwhile, is 659 feet above sea level. Thus, if you stare up at Illinois State University's Watterson Towers at 298 feet, about two-thirds of the way up, you're seeing about how much taller Bloomington Normal is than Peoria. From the back pages of the pantograph, How Time Flies Locally. 100 years ago, on April 2, 1925, Bloomington lawyers and others who knew him were shocked yesterday to learn of the death of Vespasian Warner in Clinton. Colonel Warner was a picturesque and commanding figure in central Illinois and the nation. He was commissioner of pensions, to which post he was reappointed by President Taft. 75 years ago, on April 2, 1950, the Illinois State Federation of Teachers passed a resolution at their annual conference held in Bloomington, opposing any legislation that would require teachers to take anti-communist oaths. Legislative Chairman Mary Wheeler said the resolution refers to legislation such as been proposed by State Senator Paul Broyles. 50 years ago, April 2, 1975, numerous downtown Bloomington landowners and businessmen turned out for a hearing on a development plan they felt proposes to kill off downtown Bloomington further. The most vehement objections were to closing the center and main streets at the north end of the business district. And 25 years ago today, April 2, 2000, Illinois State University's Chuck Geiger and Galen Crow have designed and implemented a cooperative ISU State Farm program that recruits and trains people who generally have no computer backgrounds as computer programmers. Those in the program often have left successful careers in order to enter the technology field. On stage, ISU's Borrowed Babies, A Tale of Stifling Sexism. The problem laid buried, unspoken, Betty Friedan wrote, for many years in the minds of American women. What problem, you ask? Ah, there's the rub, for you see, it was the problem that had no name. Friedan famously wrote those words in 1963 in The Feminine Mystique, the work that sparked the second wave of the feminist movement. That problem, opaque and nameless, was self-actualization. Why were women expected to find their validation limited to their roles as wives and mothers? Why were there so many barriers to building fulfilling careers? I mention the late, great Betty Friedan, who was a Peoria native, by the way, because in many ways her ghost haunts the touching and compelling production of Borrowed Babies, playing now through April 5th at the Illinois State University's Westhoff Theater. The 2016 play by Jennifer Blackmer tells the story of Judy London, who's played by Mia Bell Shannon, a college professor of domestic sciences who comes to loathe activists like Friedan for their overpromises. You can't have it all, she bitterly proclaims at one point. Blackmer sets the story in 2 years, 1952 and 1982, and we toggle back and forth seamlessly between them. We meet Mrs. London, as her students know her, in the autumn of her career. A home management house, brand new in 1952, is now being prepared for demolition. The university is planning to build a new technology center in its place. These practice houses were where domestic science majors applied the skills they learned in the classroom. Judy, feeling aggrieved and betrayed, is in no mood to reminisce or to offer any help to Wendy, played by Kelsey Peach, a stranger who comes to the house in 1982 looking for some answers. Wendy is searching for information about her birth parents. She spent much of her life as the ward of a children's home, but she knows there is some connection, as puzzling as it is, to Mrs. London's practice home. Despite Judy's uncooperative nature, Wendy gets the truth out of her, and it soon becomes a matter of be careful what you wish for. Wendy learns that for the first 4 months of her life, she was a practice baby for four seniors in their last semester, in essence, a capstone project in 1952. We then learn about the four young women in flashbacks. There's Brainy Bernie, played by Rosemary Urban, who dreams of a career in science. Artistic Betty, played by Stella Grace, who will move to New York. Thoughtful Louise, played by Sammy Bacara, who has plans to become Mrs. London's research assistant. And Spirited Vera, played by Peyton Cole, who's working on perfecting her chicken a la King recipe. "So I was like a class project?" Wendy asks Judy incredulously. "Well, sort of. It should be noted, though, that schools did stop the practice of using borrowed babies by the early 1970s. And in the play, the young women, under the watchful eye of Mrs. London, take loving care of the infant. While they navigate the travails of parenting a newborn, why won't she stop crying? They also begin to bump up against those sexist barriers and stifling expectations that Ferdinand would write about a decade later. We don't know the fates of Bernie, Betty, Louise, and Vera. They seem potentially positive. The same cannot be said, however, for Wendy and Judy. To say more would be to spoil the story, and it is a good one. This is a fine production with sure-handed direction by Master of Fine Arts candidate Emily Grimini. She guides these terrifically talented actresses, who also include Michelle Alexander and Ashley Snygowski, through some really beautiful and organic scenes that benefit all the more from the intimacy that Westhoff allows between audience and actors. I don't often give shout-outs to lead prop managers, and I should, but kudos to Connor Day Damick. The production has a plethora of 1950-era documents, letters, articles, syllabi. He gets them right. The paper stock seems vintage, and the typeface looks to be from a manual typewriter that might just need a new ribbon. It definitely passes the sniff test. Kate Zaragoza's costume design shines when the girls make their 1950s entrance onto the stage. Set designer Caitlin Bushwell and lighting designer Miracle Ebieri are a simpatico scenic duo who've created a very believable practice home that must credibly span three decades. If the ghost of Betty Friedan has traveled that short jaunt down Interstate 74 to ISU, I think she's likely pleased with borrowed babies. She might even give it her hearty, ethereal endorsement. And from my spot on this mortal plane, I will join her. Go see this play. It's college theater at its finest. Normal Police invite comment for CALEA. The Normal Police Department is inviting public comment as part of the accreditation process with the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies Incorporated. Starting on April 7th, a CALEA assessor will be on site for an examination of all aspects of the Normal Police Department policies and procedures, management, operations, and support services, according to the news release from Normal Police. The department has been accredited through CALEA since 1994, reassessing every 4 years. The department must meet more than 450 standards and submit annual reports for continued compliance. As part of the assessment, the public and agency employees have the opportunity to submit comments on the agency's service and performance. The public comment portal can be found online at cimrs2.calea.org/595. For more information, you can contact Accreditation Manager Jessica Ryan at 309-454-9532. Main Gallery 404 to showcase artist Philip Gangler in April. Main Gallery 404 at 404 North Main Street in downtown Bloomington will feature local artist Philip Gangler for the month of April, starting from 5 to 8 p.m. on Friday, April 4th. Gangler's work features abstracted landscapes and florals, emphasizing bold colors and impasto application of paint, offering a captivating blend of the familiar and the unexpected, and inviting viewers to explore the intricacies of his visual language, according to a news release. Gangler has built on his knowledge of painting from his college days in art and design and continues to hone his skills through various books, articles, and courses from Milan Art Institute. You can contact Bain Gallery 404 at gmail.com or call the gallery 309-590-6779. For more information. Bloomington sets spring dates for free bulk waste pickup. Bloomington Public Works crews will begin collecting bulk waste for customers of the city's solid waste program at no additional charge starting May 5th. Bulk waste will be picked up at the same time as leaves, brush, and trimmings. A calendar of all solid waste pickups in 2025 is available on the City of Bloomington's website. Bulk waste materials may include waste or debris generated from cleaning out a house or remodeling work, as well as old furniture. Items that will not be accepted as bulk waste include household garbage, appliances, and commercial or hazardous waste. Pickup will last until May 16th. Once this is over, crews will resume regular leaf and brush collection, and the collection of bulk waste will be $25 per loader bucket. For a list of bulk waste collection zones, please visit the City of Bloomington's website. AMVETS established nursing scholarship at Heartland. AMVETS Post 270 has presented Heartland Community College with funding for an endowed scholarship for aspiring nurses. The Vivian O. Stockdale Nursing Scholarship is in honor of Vivian O. Stockdale, a former Post 270 commander who served as a nurse during World War II and in the Korean conflict. Stockdale was part of the WAVES program, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, which began in World War II and allowed for women to serve in non-combat roles, according to the news release. In 1948, the WAVES were integrated into the U.S. Navy, allowing women to serve on a permanent regular basis. Stockdale became a petty officer, second class, while serving in the Navy, and later became a volunteer for American Red Cross blood drives. For more information about the nursing program at Heartland, visit heartland.edu. Woodford County offers temporary food permits. The Woodford County Health Department is advising event planners, business owners, and residents to obtain temporary food and drink permits for events. Any event involving the preparation and serving of food and drinks to the public must be inspected and licensed for public health and safety reasons, the department said in a news statement. Those events may include food truck gatherings, festivals, benefits, fundraisers, community dinners, or open houses. A temporary single-use food or drink permit is $45, and a multiple-use temporary food or drink permit is $55. Nonprofit organizations will not be charged for the permits. Even if an organization's facility has an annual license, temporary food stands also need to be inspected and licensed. For more information about temporary food permits, call the department at 309-467-3064. Lincoln man pleads guilty to DUI. A man from Lincoln pleaded guilty to aggravated DUI in McLean County and has been sentenced to prison. Marcus S. Farmer, 32, was initially charged in November 2023 with aggravated driving under the influence with a blood alcohol level of 0.16 or more, a Class 2 felony. He was also charged with misdemeanors for driving under the influence of alcohol, driving under the influence with a blood alcohol level of 0.8 or more, driving on a revoked license, as well as two traffic citations for improper lane usage and disregarding a stop sign. Because this was Farmer's fourth DUI offense, he was charged with a higher felony offense. He pleaded guilty in January to the felony and one count of driving on a revoked license. His remaining charges were dismissed as a result of his plea agreement. Farmer appeared Monday before Judge Amy McFarland, who sentenced him to 3 years in prison to be followed by 1 year of mandatory supervised release. Assistant State's Attorney David Beard appeared on behalf of the prosecution Monday, and John Bassan represented Farmer. Bassan was unable to be reached for comment after the sentencing. We'll take a short break now and then return with the second half of the Pantograph for Wednesday, April 2nd, 2025. I hope you'll stay tuned.